This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We've all been there. Someone cuts you off in traffic, you slice your finger open with a bread knife, your toilet overflows, and certain words seem to leap out of our mouths. That's exactly what happened to Dawn Herb in Scranton, Pennsylvania. She was cited for disorderly conduct after shouting profanities at her overflowing toilet. And these words prompt reactions. Her outraged neighbor, an off-duty cop, overheard her remarks, complained to the police, and Ms. Herb could face as much as 90 days in jail and a fine as much as $300. After a series of incidents, more better known, the FCC dramatically increased fines for the use of obscenities, which many broadcasters say chills free speech. So why are some words taboo? Why do they have such power? How and why do we use them? Harvard psychology professor Steven Pinker joins us to talk about why we curse and what it says about us. We'll tell you in advance that our guests and callers will not be using these words, but we still wonder, are there moments when no other words will do, and why do they provoke such strong reaction? Our number is 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later on in the program, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us. How does Al Gore's Nobel Peace Prize change the dynamic of the Democratic presidential race? You can email your questions about that now. Again, it's talk@npr.org. But now Steven Pinker joins us. He's the Johnstone Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University. His new book is called The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature, and an excerpt appears in the New Republic magazine. He joins us from the studios at Harvard. Nice to have you on the program again.
Thank you.
And I think you would say Ms. Herb was using, well, cathartic swearing.
That's right. It's one of five kinds of swearing that I distinguish in the book. And this is the kind where when some misfortune befalls you, the topic of your conversation suddenly switches to excretion or theology or reproduction.
Mm-hmm. And there are imprecations, you say. It's another term.
Yes, that's when someone cuts you off in traffic and you advise them to engage in some undignified activity or accuse them of being the kind of person who engages in some undignified activity, typically a sexual one.
Mm-hmm. And there are figures of speech then that put obscene words to other uses. I guess everybody remembers the military term snafu.
Yes, which stands for situation normal, all fouled up, except it isn't really, it wasn't fouled in the original.
Mm-hmm. Or the B-52 bomber's nickname known as the Buff, the big, ugly, fat fellow.
Yes, that's right. And there's the barnyard term for insincerity, another term that doesn't literally refer to its ordinary referent, but it's used figuratively, and mm-hmm. people know what it means.
And we could go on, but the essence of your article, it seems to me, is you're talking about why this has such emotional power, and you say it goes back to the structure of our brain.
That's right. Hearing a taboo word activates evolutionarily ancient parts of the brain associated with negative emotion. In particular, there's a brain structure called the amygdala, shaped like an almond. You have one on each side. And that's an old part of the brain that responds to threatening stimuli, to angry faces, to dangerous animals, and to swear words. And it suggests that swearing is somewhat aggressive. That is, it's forcing a thought about an emotionally charged or negative subject on a listener. It's pinging their amygdala, which gives you a kind of a wave of sweat over your skin and wakes you up and alerts you to possible aggressive threats.
Mm-hmm. And if it's in, if it provokes that kind of reaction, it suggests that this is a very old response indeed.
That's right. You can actually measure it in the little wave of sweat that comes over your skin. And what it means is that people will react to swearing as if it's a kind of attack, a kind of an act of verbal aggression. And that's why, not unreasonably, people are concerned about swearing. They don't like to be forced to think about feces and urine and degrading sex simply because they've got their ears open and someone is directing language their way.
And nevertheless, you suggest everybody does it.
Just about everybody. There are even some personality questionnaires that use I sometimes swear as part of their lie scale. If you claim you never do, then you throw out the results because it means the person wasn't being sincere.
Let's see if we can get some listeners in on this conversation. We're talking with Harvard University psychologist Steven Pinker, author of the new book, The Stuff of Thought: Language as Window into Human Nature. And part of that conversation is the use and meaning of swear words. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And why don't we begin with, this is Dustin. Dustin's with us from Casper, Wyoming.
Thanks so much for taking my call, Neil.
Sure.
Steven, I was just curious. I have a handful of friends who are teachers, California to Chicago and everywhere in between, who have come to the, I guess, their estimation on the topic is that the F word in particular with the young people is used less as an expletive and less as an adjective and more as a thinking word to have replaced because their mouths are going faster than their brains, apparently. It would be something to the effect of, yeah, hand me the F and pencil there, you know? And it's become more of an accepted word there than just using it for its even grammatic usage as an adjective or an expletive. I'm wondering if you had seen any of that in your study on this.
I think it tends to be used more for emphasis than as a filler while you're looking for a word or figuring out how to continue the sentence. I don't think it occurs in the exact positions of the sentence where and occur. And usually it's used either to emphasize that some state of affairs is emotionally trying. Oh, like they stole my effing laptop. Or as it's spread in its use, it can be just a way for a lazy speaker to wake up the listener and to try to convince the listener that there's something really compelling or arousing about what they're about to say. And I think a lot of us react to the overuse of the F word in conversation because it's a confession of desperation on the part of the speaker. It's saying, I can think of no other way of making what I'm going to say worth listening to than by pinging your amygdala, the emotionally old centers of your brain, with a shocking word.
And
that's why it's...
I was just going to say, particularly with children, though, isn't it also saying, I am a member of the adult club?
Yes, and swearing can also be used in a positive way as a kind of bonding signal among friends to say, this is the kind of setting where you don't have to watch what you say. We can use words that are taboo in society at large to show that we're at ease here. So it's another of the many uses to which taboo words are put.
Thanks very much, Dustin. Appreciate the phone call.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to, this is Lori. Lori's with us from Arlington, Massachusetts. Lori?
Yes.
Hi, Lori, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay, hi. I have a question about the particular topic or subject of swear words, that is bathroom or sexuality. I'm wondering why, or I guess sometimes it's the devil in some religions, some cultures. Why are those chosen as the subject of the swear words, and does that vary from culture to culture?
Yes, it's a great question. It does vary somewhat, and anyone who knows more than one language knows that you can't translate the swear words of one language into another without comical effect. I mean, some languages, if you were to yell out the translation of the F word, it would be yelling out make love or copulate. It just wouldn't have the same emotional
effect,
resonance.
No.
But there is a common denominator, which is that swear words in different languages all refer to something that arouses strong negative emotion. You don't have swear words for, flour and butter. Cup and baby. They're for things that strike a little bit of fear or disgust or hatred in you. There's words for sexuality, which is not always something between consenting and adults, but we have strong feelings about sex because there's also exploitation and adultery and illegitimacy and rape. Sex is a very charged topic in virtually every culture. There's deities, the supernatural, devils, saints, and so on, where the emotion is awe and fear of the power of deity. There's excretion, where the negative emotion is disgust. There are often, in many languages, there are taboo words for death and disease. Like in Yiddish, when you swear, you can yell out chalaria, cholera. And then there are often taboo terms for groups of people that are hated in that society, for infidels, for traitors, for heretics, and for repressed racial and ethnic minorities. Indeed, the most offensive word in English today, American English today, I think, is not the S word or the F word, but the N word.
And would you count that in this category of words?
I would. We don't think of it as a swear word, but at least psychologically, it surely is. It arouses a strong emotion in the part of the listener, and it is tabooed. That is, you get in trouble for saying it in most public circumstances. There are exceptions, as when African Americans use it as an affectionate or defiant way to address each other, almost neutralizing its power by saying, well, if I can use it casually, how much could it wound me? But outside of those contexts, using the N-word is probably nowadays worse than using the F-word or the S-word.
Thanks very much for the call, Lori.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Interesting. A lot of the origins, as you suggested, were religious. I'd heard, for example, even the relatively mild oath by Jiminy, of course, coming from by the Gemini. But I'd not heard the origin of blimey before.
Oh, yes. It's from May God Blind Me. And there are a lot. It's curious that we refer to the use of taboo language as swearing, which is the same word that we use for binding an oath.
Mm-hmm.
And the connection is, to make your promises credible, you often, or at least our linguistic ancestors, would try to bring in God as a guarantor to their promises. In the same way that kids today say, I hope to die if I tell a lie, mm-hmm. to make their promises more credible. In earlier times, people would say, as God is my witness, may God strike me down if I'm lying, or may God blind me, which then evolved into blimey.
And of course, these days, as opposed to bringing the deities into it, we bring lawyers into it.
Yes.
Which is a swear word of a completely other sort. Our guest
is
Steven Pinker, the Johnstone Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University, author most recently of The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. We're discussing the human nature of those little words that you can't say, and you really can't. Curse words. When do you get let loose? Are there times when no other words will do? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Also, later in the program, Ken Rudin joins us. The Political Junkie's main subject today will be the political implications of last Friday's award of the Nobel Peace Prize, at least part of it, to former Vice President Al Gore. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the usage, meaning, and power of the F word, the S word, and all those pesky curses known mostly by their first letters in polite company. Another reminder, we're in the company of the FCC, so we're certainly not using any of these words, but we're talking about why they have so much power. Our guest is Steven Pinker, the Johnstone Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard, author of The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. You can read an excerpt from it at npr.org/talk. When have you just had to use a curse word? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say at our blog. That's at npr.org/blog of the nation. And here's an email from this. I'm not sure who this is from, but years from now, the emailer asks, will these words lose their meaning or their power and just become normal?
That can certainly happen, and in fact, that has happened in the history of the language, even within the last century. For example, at the end of Gone with the Wind, when Rhett Butler says, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, that was shocking in those days. Now I assume that I can say that on the radio. And bloody also was a very incendiary term in Britain in the first part of the century, and now it's no big deal. I think, though, that as the shock value of some words declines, the shock value of other words can increase. So we replace our swear words rather than getting rid of them altogether. And a very good example is the N-word. One of the reasons that Huckleberry Finn, one of the great classics of American literature, is often the target of bans in local schools and public libraries is its common use of the N-word, which at the time was not nearly as inflammatory as it is today. Our standards have changed, and if you don't realize the standards have changed, you could think that Huckleberry Finn is a deeply racist book. And I think as our cultural sensibilities change from worrying about religion and sexuality to worrying about misogyny and racism, the most dangerous words will be those that would tend to brand the speaker as a racist or a sexist rather than as someone as a blasphemer or someone who talks too freely about sexuality.
Here's another email. This is from Manny in Sacramento. When I come across multilingual people, I'm curious to know which language they feel more comfortable speaking. And the best way to find out is to ask them, when you actually kick something with your foot in the middle of the night, which language do you use?
Yes, that's right. There is some evidence, in fact, that even bilingual speakers will feel that the swear words are more tangy, more pungent in their first language. Mm-hmm. And indeed, there's even a stronger electrophysiological response, a stronger wave of sweat or a shudder when they hear swear words in their first language compared to their second language.
And I wonder, which language do you use when you stub your toe in the middle of the night?
Oh, I couldn't reproduce it on the air.
That's fair enough.
And that would be English, yeah.
Well, speaking of not being able to reproduce something on the air, this month marks 50 years since a judge in San Francisco declared Allen Ginsberg's poem Howl not obscene.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats, floating across the tops of cities, contemplating jazz.
That's Allen Ginsberg reading the opening of his famous poem. To commemorate this anniversary, radio station WBAI in New York, a public radio station that's owned by the Pacifica Foundation, planned to air the poem, but then decided against it at the last minute, fearing censure from the FCC. Joining us now to talk about that decision is Janet Coleman. She's the arts director for WBAI and host of the show Cat Radio Cafe. She's with us from our bureau in New York, and it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
It's great to be here to talk about Howl and to listen, to have my amygdala pinging away here, worrying that all these words you're saying will be said in full.
Yes, well, we're worrying about that, too. I think for the same reason that eventually WBAI decided not to air this poem.
Yeah. The FCC had previously fined people for using the notable seven dirty words, mm-hmm. the George Carlin words, the ones we can't say, the F, the S, et cetera. In the mid-80s, the fine was something like $25,000. Very recently, they raised that fine for speech that offended community standards, a somewhat vague delineation of bad word usage, to $325,000. That's per word, per usage. That kind of made Howl, which we planned to broadcast as a reading in Allen Ginsberg's own voice, a 1959 recording that he made in Chicago, throughout the Pacifica Network as a 50th anniversary celebration of the verdict, judging mm-hmm. it not obscene. And throughout the Pacifica Network, we have five radio stations plus over 100 affiliates. That would mean, now you can't really count the words in Howl that are obscene because there are ideas there. There are excretory suggestions and sexual suggestions that might offend community standards. That is how serious and how chilling the issue has grown since Judge Clayton Horn declared that Howl was a work of artistic merit and not obscene. So we decided instead to use our website, pacifica.org, as a programming device and put on a program celebrating Howl, sort of promoting it on our radio station. You can't hear it here, but you can hear it by going online to pacifica.org, where, by the way, still remains the program with an mm-hmm. interview with Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who was the publisher
of
Howl.
Poem. Yes, of course.
A famous publisher and still out there kicking away there, kicking the government, kicking, restriction and censorship. 88 years old, a long interview with him in which he talks about the bravery, really, that was required in 1957 to publish Howl, to put it in print, and what a relief it was in 1958 to see the page liberated for not just Allen Ginsberg, but all poets.
Hmm. Now, there is some irony here. You mentioned the famous seven dirty words in George Carlin's routine. This FCC ruled on, that was, of course, a broadcast on WBAI many years ago.
Well, that's right, exactly. My former colleague, Paul Gorman, I think took it on himself to play that George Carlin record over and over again on a Saturday afternoon. I may be embroidering, but I think this story is basically not apocryphal. A father and a daughter were driving along, probably on some road in New Jersey, and listened to this George Carlin piece and was I guess I can say PO'd. He was PO'd, and he wrote a letter to the FCC complaining, specifying what the program was, what the words were, and WBAI was fined. I think the rate then was something like $25,000, $32,000, something like that. And the station took it to court. It was, you know, the Times, it wasn't that expensive if you think about it. The court costs were pretty expensive, pretty quite great. But anyway, the case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And it is now really a landmark case. All censorship cases regarding the FCC invoke Pacifica versus the FCC, the Carlin case, because it established a safe harbor wherein these dirty words could be said with an apology and a warning, yeah. And please turn your radio off if you get offended by bad speech because this will occur and it's after 10 o'clock. Get your kids under the bed because your ears might be soiled. Anyway, between 10 and 6 in the morning, you can say this stuff. And Allen Ginsberg, you know, throughout his life, really resented this particular restriction that his poem could only be heard after 10 o'clock. And it is a very strange, archaic restriction that we still have to live by.
Well, with that 50-year-old court decision in hand, why did not WBAI decide to try it again and go to court if somebody objected?
Well, we had the legal support system because it was, in fact, I was approached by a legal consortium to make this birthday reading. It included Ron Collins, the guy who got Lenny Bruce exonerated by George Pataki, finally.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A First Amendment lawyer and Ferlinghetti and
Again,
Al Bendit.
Some years after the effect, but nevertheless.
Right. Very many years after the effect. Lenny Bruce could hardly enjoy it. Only his fans. Al Bendick, who was the co-counsel for the ACLU in the Howell case, all of these people were throwing their support to this trial reading. But really, when we counted the dollars, really, they could pay for the legal fees, but who would pay for the fines? If Fox and CBS have taken these FCC fines to court and can so, you know, splendidly afford them, maybe they can. Maybe they're worried, too. I mean, if every exposure by a Janet Jackson costs a network $325,000, there's a very big chilling effect involved, you know. Anyway, it would have been a draconian fine would have basically stifled all of these community stations that WBAI supports, represents, is trying right as we speak to help license through the FCC so that we can have multiple community stations, radio stations all over the country to, you know, reflect local opinion, local thought, local art.
Janet, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Janet Coleman is the arts director for WBAI, host of the show Cat Radio Cafe, with us today from our bureau in New York. And I know Steven Pinker, not necessarily in this case, but in the other FCC cases that have been trumpeted in the past several months or so, you have some thoughts on why this is happening now.
Well, the immediate trigger was the broadcast of the Golden Globe Awards 4 years ago, in which Bono accepted an award on behalf of the group U2. And in his acceptance speech, he said, "This is effing brilliant." And that's what set the switchboards on fire and resulted in this legislation that increased fines more than tenfold. Hmm. It's ironic, though, that at a time at which the broadcast media, like radio and television, are a smaller and smaller share of total media, because we've got cable TV, which is not subject to these regulations. We've got satellite radio. We've got the internet, including streaming audio and video. There you can say anything you want. But I hope I can say this on the radio, that as fewer and fewer people are listening proportionally to broadcast radio and TV, the penalties on them are getting higher and higher. And as we're living in a golden age of free speech otherwise. I mean, you can turn on late night TV and watch comedians impugn the honesty and intelligence of the president and the vice president, and they don't have to worry about the fines that put the station out of business. But if they use certain words for sexuality and excretion, then the full weight of the government can come crashing down on them.
Hmm. Steven Pinker's new book is The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. There's also an excerpt of it in the New Republic, and you can read an excerpt from it at our website, npr.org/talk. He's His day job is as the Johnstone Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University. If you'd like to join our conversation, it's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. And this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Jim with us from North Carolina.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm a foreign language teacher in Winston-Salem, and I was wondering, I haven't heard mention of euphemisms, and I was just wondering, is there any chemical reason in the brain why they're not maybe as satisfying to people, and socially why they are more acceptable, and just the role that they play in all of this?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, because for each of the taboo words, there are polite euphemisms, both descriptively. We can talk about, you know, excrement or urine or sex, and the same subject matter won't get us in trouble. It's just those particular words. And also, when you stub your toe, if you're a very careful speaker, or you're in polite mixed company, you might say something like, shucks. Or fiddlesticks, or jeepers creepers, or gosh, or golly, all of which begin with the same sound as the obscene expression, but kind of truncated in mid-breath. So what that shows is that it isn't enough for a word to refer to something that's emotionally charged to make it taboo. It also has to be a word that people perceive as deliberately reminding them of the most unpleasant aspects of the of what the word stands for. So if I use the word feces or stool or manure or dung or guano, I'm making it clear that I have to bring it up because we've got to talk about what to put on, how to fertilize the tomatoes. I'm not bringing it up in order to gross you out. On the other hand, if I use the S word, I'm using it in order to make you think about the most disagreeable aspect of the phenomenon, which I think is why it feels more satisfying when you hit your thumb with a hammer, because when you do so, you want to say something aggressive, and so you choose the word that is understood to offend people because of the emotion associated with what you're talking about.
Thanks for the call, Jim.
Can I ask one more question?
We're running out of time. I wanted to give somebody else a chance, okay?
Gotcha. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Here's an email that we got from Mr. Deutsch. Anyway, my father was in a nursing home, apparently went into toxic shock due to gangrene. He was diabetic. He lay on the ambulance gurney and only swore nonstop for 30 minutes. These were the last words I heard from him in the 11 days before he died. Why did this part of his verbal brain keep working when apparently the rest of speech left him? It was hard for me that these were his last utterances. Excuse me, that's from Margie. Well,
It's not uncommon, and in cases where people suffer strokes and become aphasic, that is, they're no longer capable of articulate speech, they can sometimes still swear. And it suggests that there are different parts of the brain involved in swearing than in ordinary language. They're concentrated in the right hemisphere, whereas ordinary language is in the left hemisphere, and they involve emotionally ancient parts of the brain involved in strong negative emotion, rather than the higher parts of the brain that are involved in thinking and reasoning.
And would the same syndrome work for Tourette's?
Well, Tourette's is the other way around, where you've got those parts of the brain kind of working overtime. But yes, the basal ganglia, evolutionarily ancient structures in the brain, seem to be malfunctioning in the case of Tourette's syndrome, which of course is marked by involuntary outbursts of taboo words.
Mm-hmm. And many people have sent in variations on this last email question. This from Rory in Charlotte, North Carolina. I have heard the F word derived from an earlier acronym for unlawful carnal knowledge.
Yes.
Any validity to that?
None whatsoever, nor does it stand for fornication under consent of the king. It goes back to Scandinavian, probably to Old Norse, and it is a word for to thrust or to strike or to beat. Not a very pleasant connotation, but it's consistent with the fact that some of our slang terms for sex, other than the F word, also are aggressive, violent words. And it suggests there's actually some connection in our common culture between sexuality and aggression.
And this last comment, email from Crystal. You ask, are there times when no other word will do? Well, let me put it this way. I'm an Orioles fan. So, yes, this summer, sadly, lots of expletives were sent off into the universe. Steven Pinker, thanks so much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Steven Pinker is the author most recently of The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. He joined us today from the studios at Harvard University, where he's the Johnstone Family Professor of Psychology. Coming up, the political junkie takes on Gore's laurels. And here's a trivia question for you. You may remember that 3 U.S. presidents received the Nobel Peace Prize. Who's the only other vice president to win the award? Email us, talk@npr.org. And stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.